Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. My guests today are Carrie Lowry Schupeltz, author of The Indian Card. She is an enrolled member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. She spent 7 years working as a policy advisor in the Obama administration, focusing on homelessness and Native policy. In addition to an MFA in creative writing from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, she holds a master's in public policy from Harvard University and was a Fulbright scholar in Denmark. She currently teaches public policy at University of Iowa, where she is also the director of the Native Policy Lab. My other guests today are Professors Harold Prince, emeritus at Kansas State University, Professor Dan Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation, who is a professor of anthropology and chair of Native American Studies at the University of Maine in Orono. I recorded a conversation with Carrie about her book and her views on blood quantum. Given her background and experience in blood quantum research, as well as public policy, I thought a conversation with her would be very enlightening. I'll air our conversation as I recorded it a few months ago. So here's our conversation, and we'll talk on the other side. So what we were trying to do in my radio show is we're going through a series of issues on tribal sovereignty, but also on the Maine Land Claims Settlement Act, and how some of those land claims issues sort of like affected us, that we some of it we didn't even realize was affecting us. And one of those things was blood quantum. And I know you've done a lot of research on blood quantum for a lot of tribes, you know, not just Cherokee, but other tribes as well. So, and correct me, my way of thinking is that blood quantum, at least here in Maine, and tell me if you see something different, was sort of created to control resources. Sort of like, let's say that if tribal members are made to identify as using blood quantum, that eventually that blood quantum is going to run out, and that you're not going to have as many tribal members, and eventually there'll be no tribal members if you stick to that without changing it. And that's the way that I believe, and I think I've proven it, how Maine thought about this blood quantum issue. So we were really looking at this from all different sides. And when I saw that you had written a book about a blood quantum, you know, through the Indian card, and I kind of wondered about your thoughts, because I think that we don't require a card per se, just the blood quantum for our tribe anyway. And to me, there's an identity issue here. So how do you see that identity playing out, that identity issue?
I mean, in terms of blood quantum, you're absolutely right in the sense that it was a project to assimilate and eliminate Native people. It was a federal project, right? And so the first time we really saw it incorporated into federal policy was in the aftermath of the Dawes Act. And so this idea of the federal government coming in, carving up Native land that would have been held communally by different Native nations and tribes, and then allotting plots to individual Native people with the idea that they wanted them to become plot farmers. They wanted them to assimilate into Europeanized American society. And on the Dawes Rolls cards, if you were to go look at them, and these exist for, many tribes, including the five tribes of Oklahoma, on the Dawes Rolls card, there is a blood quantum column. And so, when people would come in and say, oh, I am a member of the Choctaw Nation, the Chickasaw Nation, the Cherokee Nation, federal officials would essentially adjudicate their Indianness. They would adjudicate whether they deserved a plot of land and whether they were a member of this tribe. And in doing so, they put a blood quantum number on those cards. By the way, those cards are publicly available. Anyone can go into ancestry.com or other genealogical sites and look at them. Where the federal government really began to weaponize blood quantum was in the direct aftermath of that, when they decided that any person with under one half Indian blood, quote unquote, would be entitled to their land allotment title. So they would receive the title to the land, and they would therefore own it outright. And they did this by what they called competency certificates. And so if a person was deemed quote unquote competent, they would receive their land outright. And really the only metric that was part of that calculation was their blood quantum. And so this was the first time that the federal government really started putting into place policies that stipulated any person under a certain blood quantum threshold would be considered assimilated and part of American Europeanized society. They carried this through into, I mean, they still use it on their website. For example, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, when it on their website has templates for all sorts of things, and one of those templates is for constitutions for Native nations and tribes. It still has a quarter blood quantum as the recommended membership criteria. But in the 30s and 40s, the era that you're sort of talking about, that was a period known as reorganization, where the federal government was encouraging, strongly encouraging, Native nations and tribes to form constitutions. And in the template they gave them, it had one quarter blood quantum as membership criteria. And there was a carrot and there was a stick, right? And so if a tribe didn't write a constitution, didn't pass a constitution, and if it didn't use what the federal government was suggesting they use, including that blood quantum measure, there were real consequences for that, including we may take away your funding, right? And so there were definite federal incentives and consequences for not for tribes and Native nations not using this blood quantum. But I'm always really clear that blood quantum is not a native construct at all. It is not how our people would have quantified themselves or, defined quote unquote membership. It is a federal construct.
Right. So as you were talking, you mentioned tribes were strongly encouraged to create constitutions. Why? Why did they want tribes to have constitutions?
I think part of it was they were trying to impose all of their beliefs upon tribes, right? And that included structural organization. So you should be run just like the US federal government is run. You should have, a president. I mean, you may not call it a president, but a president, a vice president. You should have a constitution. You should define your membership in certain ways. I think part of this was probably that the federal government saw itself as giving a lot of resources to tribes, and they wanted to ensure that the tribes were using the resources in appropriate ways. And one of that pieces of assurance would have been, well, we want to make sure that you have policies and laws and structures in place that look like what we want them to look like.
So,
But I would also add, not every tribe pa wrote and passed a constitution. The Navajo Nation is sort of famous in this way. that they have long stood by the idea that a constitution is not does not align with their historic traditional cultural patterns, and so although they have lots of bylaws and they certainly have rules and regulations that are written and formalized, they have long said we are not going to have a constitution.
It's interesting because, I'm not sure, but I don't think, last I knew, the Penobscot Nation refused to approve a constitution. There were some portions of the tribal members that wanted to write one. You know, of course, not everybody agrees on everything, but I think the majority won out on it. And I don't believe we have a constitution right now. Could be wrong on that. So, but this blood quantum thing, I almost think it's, I don't know if it was meant this way, maybe it was, but it is very divisive. Particularly, you know, when native people come together, you know, as I think you've mentioned before, is like, and Morgan has too, it's like you know, they talk about, oh well, how much blood are you? You know, and it's sort of like if you're not, if you don't make that level of quantum, then you're the other. So I think it's a tool to otherize, you know, native people against each other. At least that's
Yeah,
what it's
absolutely.
happened. Yeah.
I mean, in addition to that, I always try to be really clear that blood quantum, certainly the way the federal government executed it, was a tool of extinction. It was meant to ensure that there would be no Native people left after a certain amount of time. And, you know, there recently was a study done by the Wilder Institute, which is a research organization up in Minnesota. They were commissioned to do a study of blood quantum by one of the tribes in Minnesota. And what they found, and this was a tribe that was using a quarter blood quantum, what they found was that if that tribe continued to use a quarter blood quantum in 100 years, they would virtually be extinct. I mean, there would be so few people left that could claim one quarter blood quantum that you're looking at a lack of survival. And that's what really scares me. I mean, I generally don't agree with blood quantum, but every tribe is entitled to its own decision making. I firmly believe in the idea of sovereignty. And, you know, so what a tribe chooses to use for membership is completely up to that community. But I do believe that just like I, a citizen of the United States, have the right to criticize my government and want it to do different things and, you know, sort of make those opinions clear, I also believe that members of tribes and citizens of Native nations get to do that too. And so if it's the case that tribal members don't want to use blood quantum anymore, they don't think it's serving the tribe well, they're scared for the tribe's survival, they have the right to make that known to the tribe and have a real conversation about what do we do? What is our goal moving forward, and is blood quantum serving us well?
So, in your research, have you come across any tribes that have decided, well, we're not going to use blood quantum anymore?
I've come across a few tribes that have decided to restart their roles. And so what that means is I've seen it done differently, but in one instance, everyone who was on the original roll is now at 4/4 blood quantum. I've also heard of it being done where everyone currently enrolled is now 4/4. I mean, it solves the problem in the short term, but it basically kicks the can down the road. I mean, your children and grandchildren and great grandchildren are going to have to figure this out. So that's primarily what I see when I see tribes making a decision to change blood quantum rules.
There are tribal members who feel that if we bring people that are less than quarter blood back into the community, we're also bringing in these other problems. Like there are some people that are into drugs. There are some that are really not all that, and we would bring in that baggage, I guess, that we didn't have, and also would delete our resources.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the book I tried to hypothesize why it is that tribes continue to use blood quantum. And it's sort of exactly what you're talking about. So one is, well, we don't have a lot of resources, and if all of a sudden we open ourselves up to many, many, many more people who qualify for those resources, the pieces of the pie shrink for everybody else. Another, I think, is the idea of degree of connection. So it is probably easy to imagine that people with very, very, very low blood quantum, right, are less connected to the tribe. Maybe they have never been to the community. Maybe they don't know anyone in that community. There's no one to claim them there. And who knows if that's the case? That would sort of be my guess that that is the case. And so possibly it's the case that tribes want to make sure that people enrolled are people who are connected to the
Right,
tribe.
right.
And I do think there is that element of protection too. And from a very logistical, pragmatic standpoint, tribal roles require resources themselves. Conducting a tribal role is hard. It requires people and money and time. And if what you're using is a tribal role from, excuse me, 1896, and it has blood quantum in it already, and that's what you've been using for 140 years to base your current policies off of, I can imagine it's hard to conceive of a world in which you change that. It's going to be hard. It's going to be really
Sure.
hard for you to change that policy. And so I think that it's unsurprising in a way, the thought that tribes are still using blood quantum, from a very pragmatic standpoint. What I was particularly surprised at, though, when I was writing this book, and part of the book was data collection, and I ended up creating a database of all 347 federally recognized tribes in the contiguous United States. And what I was surprised by was the fact that more tribes use blood quantum than don't. I guess I thought maybe it would not be the case, but it turns out that the majority of tribes in the lower 48 are using blood quantum. My own tribe does not use it. And so, I haven't particularly had to internalize that measure for myself. But yeah, I mean, the majority do. And so I think that this is a real conversation that Native people and Native tribes are having right now is, do we continue to use this? And what would be the alternative if we didn't?
Yeah, and that's the key question is what would be the alternative? And then, I sort of in thinking about this, I think we actually went back to 18, I think it was 60, and declared that everybody in 1860 was 100%. And then we did that again later. And I forget what year that was. But again, it's like what you said, it's kicking the can down the road. And in the meantime, you're still losing membership. So, in thinking about that, Maine tribes have been kept at a small number on purpose. And my thought was, well, what if we decided years ago not to do this? Would we have larger tribal? A larger tribe? Would we have more members? Would we have more power in voting and that sort of thing? And with new with new people, we would have new talent. So it kind of works, in different ways, not just to deplete the resources, but also to add to that. And we've never looked at it that way.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you sort of pose the question, what would be the alternative? I mean, there is actually a pretty natural alternative, which is what the other half of tribes are using. So there's basically two ways you can do enrollment, right? One is through blood quantum, and one is through a lineage-based system. And it still requires a person to connect themselves to a direct ancestor on a roll. It just doesn't require them to quantify
Right.
how connected they are.
So, Darren, what do you think of what Carrie has talked about?
Yeah, no, and I thought that was a really good interview and really to the point in some ways. Like she mentioned the about the one tribe in Minnesota, like where they did an analysis of like quarter blood in 100 years and sort of how that played out. I mean, I think that just so easily distills into like, the logics of blood quantum of like, to actually do that work. I think we see that, in the ways in which our roles, say at Penobscot, have slowed down, right? In terms of our numbers increasing. I think we've seen in the last 40 plus years is this like shift from other blood quantums towards a quarter. Quarters now by far, in terms of our citizens at Penobscot, the highest kind of one. But then you kind of abstract that out for the next 50 to 100 years. It really does. It really is a death knell, a way of kind of erasing ourselves and engaging in that way. So I think that really distilled, some of the issues around it. Of course, like her, I believe in what tribal sovereignty means, that it is really up to us to decide this, and that people, continue to use blood quantum as a form of identification. And I thought she did a fairly good job at thinking about that, like why it's continued use. In previous discussions, I had talked about blood quantum can sometimes, and she talked about it as connection to the community, right? Like as a filling in to like the connection to the community. I've talked about it as sort of closeness of kinship ties, to people from the community, degree of connection. And so I think that anxiety of like, and again, for us at Penobscot, and I think this is true for Passamaquoddy's as well, and to a lesser extent, probably the two northern tribes. The legacy of the Settlement Act, and the kind of people that came home, came back during and after that, sort of rings this sort of this feeling of disruption, and sort of how changing the rules might again lead to this disruption of community. And what people feel about it. So I thought, on those two issues alone, I thought she offered, I think, a really kind of direct sense of who and what is at stake. I also thought like this sort of dichotomy around, what's the alternative, this sort of lineal descent framework, and really calling that out as the sort of obvious other piece of this. So, that feels like a real dramatic shift. Going from blood quantum quarter to lineal descent, that would really, open up things in a way that would feel very dramatic to people. That's why my predictions have always been a little bit of a slow roll into what would otherwise be thought of as lineal descent, where I think the next move would be something around changing base roll dates, but just that seems less scary, perhaps, for people. It doesn't open up, that far. But I thought she had some really kind of clear, obviously thought about these issues quite a bit.
Yeah, and I noticed that, of course, she worked with the Obama administration on tribal policies issues for like 8 years. And, so, did a lot of research, and the study that she mentioned that you had just mentioned was the Wilder Institute study
Yeah.
in Minnesota, and that study was about blood quantum. And the finding on that was that the tribes that take on blood quantum, if they just follow through with blood quantum, they'd be extinct in 100 years. So there's some stuff we got to stop kicking the can down the road on this issue, because there'll be no tribes left.
Yeah, I mean, I think Penobscot, right? Like, we've already taken on. It probably would be less dramatic for us. I'm not saying it's going in the same direction, but the mere fact that we count other Indian blood, right? It puts us in a really unique category. Actually, the very few tribes do that. So, that would be something that would mitigate that, I think, a little bit. But yeah, it's been really. It distills it. Yeah. And the idea that we would just sort of not plan for this, not have a really deep and broad community discussion around it, which, I think at times people have tried to pull that in, but almost like in a way that, I don't know, it feels like it's not a discussion people want to have. Like it's uncomfortable. And so I think that is really I wish there were more ways that we could all come together to discuss that outside of, say, a council meeting or a general meeting, because I feel like there's a lot of kind of sitting in a circle or sitting with one another that would further this discussion, because otherwise it's going to be unfortunately, it'll be responding to crisis points as opposed to planning. And I don't think that's the way to deal with this.
Right. And the thing is that her tribe, the Lumbee, it was kind of surprising to hear that they don't go by blood quantum. They go by lineage. And they talk about the piece of the pie. The pie doesn't get any bigger when federal recognition wise or whatever, just gets smaller as the tribes are federally recognized. The pot that they get their money from gets smaller. So in southern tribes like the Lumbee, I think Harold has some interesting thoughts about that. So go ahead, Harold.
Yeah, it's a the issue of blood quantum, and we've talked about it before with respect to the divisions that are not only apply to indigenous North Americans, but also throughout Latin America and also to other groups. A quick first comment regarding what Darren was just referring to in the interview you did with Carrie earlier, and that is that if you apply the quarter blood rule that after X amount of generations, a community is basically becoming extinct, right? So it's a form of genocide. But that is only true if you include some variables. One of them is that if you don't impose rules of marriage, meaning inside the group marriage, and if you don't have a reproductive rate that is larger than 2.1, right? For a population to stay static, you need a average number of children per conjugal unit of 2.1 that accounts for the death of someone before reaching adult stage. And so you see that with the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, who have dramatically increased their numbers by A, having large families, B, by applying strict rules of endogamy, as anthropologists referred, marrying inside your own group. So that if you don't apply the rules that enforce marriage within your own group, you have a different dynamic that plays out over the course of generations than if you have a group that doesn't impose those rules. So that's just the logic, and we know plenty of examples of that. So the sheer fact of the application of the quarter blood rule is not automatically linked to extinction of the community in X amount of generations. You need to include the element of reproductive rate, and the other one is the application of strict enforcement of endogamy. So those people who don't comply by those rules, like with these very orthodox harem, I forgot exactly the exact name of them, but they're very, very large now in Israel. I think about close to 20% of the population that makes their exemption of military service now a real problem in the state of Israel. It's a good example of a unique legal status that a group had. So coming back to Indian country, the other thing is that not only is there a sharp divide between the tribes west of the Mississippi and east of the Mississippi, as we all know, but there's also a north-south divide. And in other words, the sense of being indigenous for a Lakota, which is a large group, that plays out very differently than for, let's say, a Hopi or a Navajo, but also for the Catawba in South Carolina, for example, as opposed to the Lumbee. That's a good example of a sharp difference. But also within South Carolina itself, North Carolina itself, the distinction between the Eastern Band of Cherokee, who opposed the Lumbee in their effort at gaining federal recognition. If you understand the dynamics of that from an historical point of view, you realize how complex these issues really are. And just to make a small comment, Kerry mentioned that the Lumbee now number about 50,000 people. The Eastern Band of Cherokee numbers about 14,000. And so within the state of North Carolina, you see a tribe that will suddenly be, if there is federal recognition, be overwhelmed by a much larger group, the Lumbee, who are from the Eastern Band of Cherokee point of view, who also are very critical toward the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma because they are very conservative. They refuse to participate in the Trail of Tears. They were hiding in the mountains, are historically very conservative and very cohesive. So with the remnants of Cherokee who escaped the exodus of the 1830s of the Trail of Tears and who did not join or were not part of what became the Eastern Band of Cherokee, there was intermarriage with both poor whites as well as blacks. And out of these entities, you got groups that had some sort of identification with indigenous peoples, in part because the identification as black in the historically slave states was horrific. So any effort to distantiate yourself from black ancestry and emphasize indigenous ancestry or white ancestry was a logic that has to be understood in the context of the slave history in this country. And so that gets me back to the Lumbee, a name that was imposed on them by Congress, if I remember, in the 1950s, based on the Lumber River, right? It's the Lumber River that runs through Robeson County. And so that became, if you pronounce it in the way it would have been pronounced there, instead of Lumber River, it became Lumbee River, Lumbee River. And so here was a whole group of people who historically somehow felt real or imagined, I cannot judge, in some cases real, some cases perhaps not. They formed these triracial communities. And if you impose the one drop rule that we have talked about before on these triracial communities, if you have one drop of African ancestry, you were deemed to be black. And so a lot of Native Americans or groups with mixed heritage try to avoid the repercussions of that rule. So in other words, what I really want to say only is that when you talk about, or we talk about the blood quantum issue and you remove it from the confines of Indian country itself and see it in a larger context, you suddenly start seeing all kind of historical, political, ideological, and economic factors playing out.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty complicated. I mean, from like a 30,000 foot view, there's just so many things that can come from that. But what you said earlier, though, Harold, about just letting the blood quantum, go without doing anything, doesn't really equate to genocide. Is that what you said? Did I understand that?
Yeah, it's basically what I'm saying, because that's not a necessity, right? Is I'm saying that that implies whoever did that study was making including variables in that calculation that gets a certain kind of outcome. And if you apply it, for example, to the Navajo Nation, right? The Navajo Nation has enormously grown But the issue of blood quantum hardly plays out there because the population is has become so large. It's very different for the Cherokee, where the outcome has been different. And the nice thing about the discipline that Darren and I have acquired our doctorates in, namely anthropology, is that we study the local in order to get a sense of the global, right? In other words, the global is always embedded in the local. And by looking much closer up, first at a particular case and then extrapolating to a wider canvas, we begin to see differences and similarities and then try to tease out what exactly is going on. And sometimes we come out at a viewpoint that leads us sometimes to unexpected places, and sometimes they're uncomfortable. And anthropology has found itself repeatedly in the crosshairs of dominant ideologies that do not like what we are seeing based on science.
Okay, so this if we bring that quarter blood policy into Maine, Maine just didn't leave that by itself. They had a bill that actually took away membership from the women and the children. So they sort of coupled that along with other things. So I think when you have these other policies affecting that quarter blood status, I think that creates genocide, that sort of thing.
But you're right, if I may quickly comment on that. You're right, when you there's a big difference, A, between a small community and a large community. If you have a population of, let's say, 10,000 or 20,000, as opposed to a population of about 400 to 600, as historically was the case with the Penobscot, you see the dynamics being very different. If you look at the small Indian islands without any indigenous community in nearby, you're almost writing a bill of extinction. By any measure, right? It's too small to do it. And as a result, there has been a lot of intermarriage, as you know, between the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy, but also between the Maliseet from Tobique, and even beyond, right? Even from Nova Scotia, Mi'kmaq have married into the Penobscot Nation. With the Mi'kmaq which is a much larger group, right? That's about today, maybe about 35 to 40,000. I may have old numbers by now. The same threat to survival for the Mi'kmaq, even for the Mi'kmaq in northern Maine, because they're closely connected by kinship ties to about, what is it, 29 First Nations across the border. The Penobscot didn't have that. And so historically, the Penobscot needed to have intermarriage in order to stay within the blood quantum rules with Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq, as well as Abenaki from Odernak, although to a much lesser extent, and Bécancour or Wabanaki.
Aaron.
Yeah, I've been trying to just think about, what Harold's saying in terms of, I think that study from Minnesota feels similar to, I think, what we would face. I think we can look at our census reports, Donna, and see this shift from, in blood quantum towards quarter blood, and look past over the years when quarter bloods became the sort of majority of our tribe, and however many years ago, and that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm not super psyched about like how to playing the game of blood quantum is always a game of diminishing returns, right? So it's like even me bringing that factoid up, vis-a-vis the kind of like what are the impacts of say a quarter blood. I think taking into account though these other pieces of it, right? And you mentioned the policy that was sort of a mimicking attempts at mimicking the kind of patrilineal patriarchal rule that in Canada, Bill C-31, like that legacy of the Indian Act, where a woman marrying outside of the tribe would lose their ta status, right? Like, and then the children. So that idea, when they've used all sorts of tools around citizenship slash enrollment to, as she mentioned in the interview, and you guys connected it to this larger history of like, dramatic forms of forced assimilation And the blood quantum pieces come sort of online in a heavy rotation at the same time, not by coincidence, right? They're the forced assimilation and the Dawes Act and the thing, and many of these same very similar policies we faced, kind of 50 years earlier, or some form of those earlier, the forced farming situation, the reallocation and rethinking or forced into sort of forms of democracy that were not our traditional governance system, like all the things around forced assimilation and then blood quantum and how those sort of function to literally, erase us and get rid of us as indigenous people, right? So I think, what we have there and how we answer the question, right, of who we are. In response to what we know these policies are meant to do, and what we know will be these long-term impacts, again, are the real huge challenges. But I would say, the relative complicatedness of Indigenous people's identity and identities in our citizenship in, I think, at least in the Western Hemisphere, I think that sort of Colombian, all of that, and that includes the Anglo, Francophone, and Spanish kind of context, that the various ways that our nations, if we're nations, right, get intertwined with the concept of race and how we become racialized through colonization, and then how contemporary views of race and racialization and belonging and culture, right, get intertwined with the decision-making matrix that we have now for these issues, right? Which is to say, we have been racialized, so we are in that category as Indigenous people. Many of us are treated a certain way because of our racialization and the way we look, and then other of us don't. But then how that gets intertwined again. Intertwined is quite complicated, but it makes it even more critical for us to have this very, I think, deep discussion within our communities and not just sort of let it lie, because I think it's the status quo, right, around those things again are just so potentially dramatically damaging. And it would be a real opportunity for us to kind of, reassert our sovereignty. And one of the few things that it seems like the Settlement Act gives us in terms of who we are and what we can manage is sort of who, our citizenships. What the internal tribal matter seems to be, the thing that is recognized as our sovereign domain in the Settlement Act. And that tends to be really most engaged with sort of governing who we are. And so I think starting from a very strong position in that way, I think, is a real, real strong expression of sovereignty as well. So I think we can see it as an opportunity to kind of wrestle it with it as an expression of sovereignty and not as a, not as a kind of damage control over our inevitable demise or whatever. I think there's a real more positive spin on that in terms of community relations and sort of how we want to be sovereign going into the future.
Harold.
Yeah, I completely concur. From as a foreigner looking at the conundrum that Penobscot and other, in particular, smaller tribes are facing, and also in terms of sovereignty, in the sense of the actual meaning of the term self-governance, which is also the self-governing of identity, both on a personal level as well as on the level of community. It gets more complicated when you're dealing with natural resources or other commodifiable elements where you see the means of subsistence in a community come in play. And you see that played out with the casino issue, right? The casino can be, in many cases, a form of substantial income. In many cases, it's not, right? We have not we should not overestimate the income generate or the revenue generating capacity of casinos. But nevertheless, you see tribal membership suddenly becomes an issue. Who gets to share in the dividends of a profit-making enterprise? So when you have means of subsistence that get linked to limited natural resources, in particular land, which has been a recurrent issue in Donna's looking at these issues, rightfully so, land is an issue. But if you have a lot of people on a small piece of land, you get growing population pressure and diminishing returns per individual. So anyone who is a responsible government in terms of sovereignty has to look at the resources available per capita of the population. And so that's one thing. The other thing about identity and sovereignty, and you both have referred to it numerous times, is the sense of personal identity. I think that Morgan, who's not with us today, could speak to this better than I, obviously, but who are you is the basic question, right? And Darren just referred to the racialization of identity. And that leads me back to the Lumbee, a person who did not have that status when he lived, because the name Lumbee was not applied as a ethnic category at the time. But it was a very famous American person of triracial background by the name of Sylvester Long from North Carolina. I don't know if Donna, you may not have heard of him, but he's better known as Chief Buffalo Child Longlands. And Chief Buffalo Child Longlands, born in 1890, died of suicide in 1932. But his case is fascinating because he was born of mixed African American, Euro American, and Native American background. In order to qualify for West Point, and he was very bright, and for an Indian school as opposed to a school for blacks. He basically claimed he was Cherokee initially. And so he was then recommended by the President of the United States during World War I to be for admission to West Point Academy as Cherokee. But he was not an enrolled Cherokee. He was a triracial person who lived in the one of the settlements of North Carolina and was considered to be under North Carolina racial laws more black than anything else. So he realized that it was going to be a background check for West Point that was going to be more severe than he had faced when he enrolled in the Indian school. And he left for Canada. It was World War I. He was admitted and behaved extremely well in the Canadian Armed Forces and stayed in Canada afterwards and kind of more or less reinvented himself as a Blackfoot Indian of the Blood Nation and claimed he was adopted by the chief there. And was given the name Buffalo Child Longlands. And so he wrote an autobiography growing up in the Great Plains, completely reinventing himself, and was a fascinating case because he was also a good boxer. And he was boxing against a guy, I've forgotten his name, may have been Dempsey, who would have never fought against a black opponent, but an American Indian component was going to be great. And so, anyway, he joined the Explorers Club in New York, became a movie actor in Hollywood, and then shot himself in Los Angeles, I think in 1932. So he wrote both his own invented autobiography, but there's also quite a lot of research was done on him. But I highly recommend looking more carefully at him because he personifies the tragedy of imposed racialization by dominant society. Where you ultimately get a man who is forced to deny his heritage in terms of the complexity, and is creating an identity that's more Hollywood inspired than anything else.
So identity is huge, right? I mean, this blood quantum thing really does affect identity in a lot of ways. Darren.
No, I think it's so interesting because I want to go off in this tangent that Harold just brought up
Go ahead.
because, well, partly because Chief Buffalo Child was in The Silent Enemy, which also had our kin Molly spotted out Molly Del Nelson. So that's interesting, just as a factoid. To say like we're connected to that person and through the cinematic lens. Although quite clearly, you know, that unlike Molly, of course, who grew up right in our community and returned to our community, Chief Buffalo Child, had a much more, different, a different connection or lack of connection to a real specific Indigenous identity. So I think, I think that there are just different ways of engaging in that. And I think, how we make that decision is really important. I will say that, the broader issue of thinking about citizenship versus membership versus who we are racially, I think is also very important. I think for our tribes here, I think Wabanaki tribes broadly, but I think when I think of Penobscot, Passamaquoddy in particular, the sort of our experiences through colonization, first dealing with this sort of issues between the English and the French, and then dealing with the sort of American versus British, our kind of who we are is tied to nationhood in a way that is really important. And I think because our discussions about who we are and what role we have in terms of governance and location and traditional territory and decision making and kind of sort of all of those things that have led to us, I think, as the one, non-border tribe, in a way, Penobscot, like not being on the border, I think that framework of nationhood and diplomacy is so much a part of why we are still here. And so I really do think that an under you know really deep understanding of those pieces of who we are, I think this is true for every tribal nation, like that being in touch with that and engaging in that as a part of the discussion around something like blood quantum, or what is our baseline for citizenship? How do we recognize one another as kin, and which is the formation of kind of a tribal identity, and then how do we function together broadly as a community, and what ties us, together, I think is really fundamental to the alternative frameworks of, outside of blood quantum. So that idea of lineal descent is always there, but I think that transition point needs to be really well thought through in terms of what ties us together as a nation or as a community and as a nation, and sort of what does that the future of that look like?
Harold.
Yeah, a quick comment. I was thinking when Darren was commenting on the history and survival and identity and future, I was thinking about the impact of the great pandemic, and that was a real pandemic, not like the COVID pandemic, which was child play by comparison. And that is the Holocaust that Indian country here in Maine, as well as on the coast of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, experienced between 1615 and 1619, when 75 to 95% of the population was wiped out. And if you think about the tremendous collapse, if you have a survival rate in the case of 95% extinction, that means only one out of 20 people survives. So when you begin to look at these small communities, if you have, let's say, a town like Halliwell losing 95% of its population, and let's say Halliwell has 5,000 people, you do the math, you have almost nothing left. So Halliwell is forced to join with Gardner and Augusta in order to survive as a urban community, can't do it on itself. So there have been historically a lot of adaptations that Wabanaki have made, including intermarriage, in particular with the French. Darren, of course, is a lovely example of the Franco-Wabanaki intermixture. Many Penobscot have French ancestry, as we all know. But without that, they might not have survived. So here you get the issue of blood quantum applied to these marriages that have taken place in the past with French Catholics, French Canadian, or French Acadian, Catholics and Wabanaki Catholics at the time that were sanctioned by the church, although opposed by often by the state. And here you see very complicated historical dynamics at work that historically have been solved by making the necessary adaptations. And I'm sure that in the future, similar kind of solutions will be found.
Darren, last word.
Yeah, no, I think love to have the last word on this. And it's so hard to talk about this in abstraction, you know, with just, you know, there's always kind of this political component, you know, how our community does and does not talk about this issue, right? And I think it functions in very real ways, right? Like passing on a home within a family, right? That's like a big issue, right, Donna? Like, I mean, you know, when out marriage and then citizenship, you know, like how that, you know, when those lines of possibility start to fracture or end, you know, I think that's when people really visit it, and for a variety of really good reasons. And that's why, like, it just causes so much heartbreak, you know, like, you know, and then it creates that sense of like, you know, then you start to look over at your neighbor who has like a, you know, a non-tribal citizen like living there, you know, just like because they're whatever X, Y, and Z, and then, you know, like I just don't want it to be the politics of small things that motivates our discussion around it, but that really is about, because I, you know, at its core, the value system that makes, you know, the culture of welcome so important to Wabanaki people, and the greeting of the dawn and all of the things that I think are so beautiful within our cultures as Wabanaki people is just, and that strength of that, the diplomacy and all of the things, like, you know, I feel like we really just need to access that for deciding something like this. And your interview with Carrie and the last few weeks, last few months, talking about this issue, it's made me kind of nervous that we're not having a more vibrant discussion around it. And that's not because I have like a plan for, you know, doing it in this way or that way or the other. I honestly do want to hear from our fellow tribal citizens about like, what is the future they're thinking about with regard to this issue. I think that's really important that we have it, that we, you know, take a beat to really consider it and be together with each other as we decide it. So I'm hoping maybe we can join together, Donna. We get a little coalition at a general council meeting or something. I don't know. It feels always predetermined, and I haven't been to one in a while. So, you know, I don't know. It's always like hard to kind of reckon how we get this, you know, going in the community. But I think it's a really important discussion for us to have.
Well, thank you, Darren. And I totally agree. And let's get to it. I want to thank our special guest, author of The Indian Card, Carrie Lowry Schupelz, Professor Harold Prince, author, Darren Ranko, for being on the show today. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and Joel Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.